You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a bright, beautiful, sunny Davis day. Oh, Don, I'm so happy to be able to say that for the next 3 months.
Roughly speaking, yes. A few clouds may go across the sky at some point later in the week, but nothing major on the horizon. Been a pretty balmy last few days. Today's date, June 3rd, 2026. Lois and I are preparing the show for broadcast June 4, 2026, only 2 weeks away from the longest day of the year. It's 66 degrees right here, at least at the University Airport in the Davis area, going up to a high today, they're saying, of 94 degrees, which will be warmer than it's been for a few days. Low tonight will be 60. Thursday is going to be the highest, hottest day of the next several with 97 degrees, and Thursday night will be 59, then 95 on Friday without a cloud in the sky from the looks of it. Friday night, 58 degrees, slight cooling trend. Saturday, 87. Saturday night, 55. Sunday, 86. Sunday night, 55. Monday, 83. Monday night, 56 with a slight chance of rain.
What?
Not sure where that's coming from, but there it is on the National Weather Service. Partly cloudy Monday night with a slight chance of rain with a low around 56. And then I guess that scoots right out of here. And Tuesday will be mostly sunny with a high near 85. So mid-80s during the day, bumping into the low 90s a couple of times, mid to upper 50s at night. Remember back in January, February, when we were talking about ideal planting weather for summer vegetables, mid-50s to mid-80s? Well, there we are. And we are having conversations.
So, Don, I wanted so it's spring, it's summer, our weather's going warmer and cooler and warmer, yes. And it does that, and it does that every year,
yes.
But yet I look at an average temperature, which mm-hmm. is the average today would be 88, and it's like, that may be the average, but it doesn't take into account the fact that we're going up and down all the time.
Well,
because we do.
That's what averages are. And we've certainly had our share of ups and downs this season with temperatures in March in the upper 80s to low 90s and then dropping down with very cold nights in early April. But this is pretty average right now, indeed, as you know. So the average temperature on, let's say, June 4th.
It's 88.
Yeah. And going to be at the end of the month, the average high will be 92. So that's what we do in June, as we go from the mid 80s to the low 90s as our average high. We typically, in my experience here in the Sacramento Valley, we typically hit 100 degrees sometime late May or early to mid June. It has not happened. We haven't even been particularly close to it yet so far. So pretty mild temperatures. Night temperatures have been low 50s. This is pretty ideal for transplanting. We have a lot of people very concerned. We hear things like, well, the heat's coming on, or is it still okay to plant? Obviously, with the correct follow-up watering, which I think we harp on here sufficiently that we can talk about it later in the show. I don't need to go into that right now, but it does look like mild weather going for the rest of this week, and highest temperature is going to be around 90 to the very low 90s. Night temperature is very mild, and of course, as we say, sunny. The soil condition is ideal right now. I've been out planting like crazy. If you soak everything down a couple of days ahead of time, then go in and turn or break into your soil to plant little seedling vegetables and flowers and things like that, you will find it's just about ideal right now. It should crumble in your hands, adequate moisture to get the roots established. The key thing, obviously, water it in as you plant it. Check daily. Water as needed. You may not need to water daily. I've been putting in vegetables like crazy. May is my busy vegetable planting month. It's been almost, briefly, there was one wind spell there where I had to water each day. Otherwise, it's typically every other day. And but I check every day. I go out there and I check, because here and there, there'll be one smaller plant I put in, a little squash plant that was in a 2-inch pot instead of a 4-inch. There's a watering can out there. One of the last things I do before I leave the vegetable garden each evening is fill up the watering can, leave it there. So when I check in the morning, I can make a quick decision. I don't have to turn the valve on, do all that stuff. I just water that plant and go. But check daily, water as needed. I will say, things that I put in within 5 to 7 days are not needing daily watering. In most cases, not even needing every other day watering in my garden soil. But the pictures we're looking at, as folks come in with their raised planters, their containers, things like that, they're drying out very rapidly. So we're having to have a lot of conversations about how to thoroughly and effectively irrigate flowers, vegetables, new trees, young citrus, which are going in now. It's a great time to plant citrus, things like that. How to water them. Once you get that figured out, this is a great time of year to plant things. We've got all those kind of public service announcements to do. We've got, first of all, remind you that KDRT is public radio, community radio. That means we rely on contributions from listeners like you to fund our operating costs. If you like what you hear, head on over to kdrt.org and click on the support button. A little programming or station note. The RSS feeds are working. What that means is the podcasts are loading. We had 2 weeks there in which things were not going as planned, shall we say. Diligent work by our stalwart volunteers at the station and the extremely generous consultant who came in and helped troubleshoot everything should all be back in order. But I do want to thank at least a couple of you who contacted us and some who contacted me directly to let us know that the podcasts weren't there. Because interestingly, I hadn't checked that. And I went on, our podcast is not there. Oh, look, none of the other podcasts for the station are loading either. And it was about then that others at the station became aware of the problem. So your notes and comments help. Just want to thank you for those of you that got in touch with us to say the show is not there. And also, Keith, thank you for letting us know when the show is back there. So things are back in order. The station's operating system is living on borrowed time. But for now, we've borrowed a little more and we should be able to get going forward for the time being. Again, thanks for your notes and comments. They're very, very helpful.
And the station is working on making it so that we don't have to have this announcement ever again.
We hope so.
it's in process, but be reliable. That's what our goal is.
That's our goal for the year. Be reliable.
Yes.
we set our sights low.
Okay. So I wanted to just remind people, I know we've announced it before, but this weekend on Saturday is the Davis Pride celebration. And so there's going to be a number of bands playing. I'm not going to read everything. And it's happening in Civic Center Park. That's in the behind the Davis City Hall at 6th and B Streets.
I want to mention Rocky Outcrop, who's been bringing amazing guests into the studio. If you're listening to the live broadcast of the Davis Garden Show, you can still catch this one. Listening Saturday, you better go online and listen to the rebroadcast. Rocky Outcrop is welcoming 15-time Grammy winner Ricky Skaggs.
Ricky Skaggs.
To the Yolo County Breakdown. Okay, folks, we have a little tiny radio station in Davis, yes. California, 95.7 FM. We actually broadcast maybe to the edge of town, but worldwide on KDRT.org. Bella Fleck, Renee Fleming, and now we have Ricky Skaggs coming to KDRT, thanks to Rocky Outcrop and his connections in the music industry. That will be Friday for the live broadcast, June 5th at 10 a.m. right here. Ricky Skaggs first took the stage with Bill Monroe at the age of 6 years old and has left an indelible mark on music history. You can hear an interview and some of his music on Yolo County Breakdown, Friday, June 5th, 10 a.m. And for rebroadcast of that program or all the other great programming here, let's say maybe Davis Garden Show, you missed one of them and you can't find it in your podcast, you can always go to kdrt.org, click on the show page, and there they are archived. And so if you happen to miss the live broadcast of Yolo County Breakdown, it'll be there for 2 weeks after it broadcasts, and you can check it out that way. And you can also click on the RSS feed. If it happens to be working, the podcast will download to your computer. So, Ricky Skaggs coming to KDRT.
If you missed our show at any time, right, you don't have to worry about the two-week limit, because we're not limited. We're forever.
That's right. We're a public.
And everything is really, really confused and you're not sure what's going on, you can always go to our personal show website, davisgardenshow.com. And the shows are archived there. Don puts them up there regularly.
Okay, Arboretum is kind of going into summer mode, but the folk music jam sessions continue every week at noon to one, every Thursday. Is that? Yes, every Thursday. And Wyatt Deck, which is easy to find, but I suggest if you've never been before, you should check out the map first. It's in the center east end of the Arboretum near the Redwood Grove, if that helps. Folk music jam sessions, musicians are invited to bring their acoustic instruments and play together informally during this jam session. And then, June 17th, you can get ready to immerse yourself in the vivid beauty of the UC Davis Arboretum as you embark on a midday adventure through gardens, collections, stunning humor with your guide, Warren Roberts, Superintendent Emeritus, on the Walk with Warren, June 17th at noon. That'll be at the Shields Gazebo, far west end of the Arboretum. Very easy to find, parking nearby. So Walk with Warren coming up June 17th.
And if you live in Davis and you have never gone on a walk with Warren or been to one of his lectures or anything, I encourage you to do it because it's an experience.
There's a
He's wonderful.
behind the scenes tour of the Good Life Garden, which is occurring also on Wednesday, June 17th. Oh, you've got to choose. Huh. 12 to 1, 12:10 to 1 p.m. Go behind the scenes of the Good Life Garden, calling all edible gardening enthusiasts. Join landscape adaptation fellow J.R. Balangasa for a tour of the Good Life Garden in the RMI courtyard. This garden features raised beds with vegetables, fruit trees, and ornamental plantings that support pollinators and other biodiversity. Visit this relaxing and colorful garden just as summer gets underway, to learn about the many crops we can grow in our climate. Pre-registration is not required, but please arrive on time to the meeting location. It is a tour. Participants are encouraged to wear comfortable walking shoes and consider bringing a water bottle. It will be canceled in the case of an extreme heat event, which, looking at the weather, seems extremely unlikely. So these events are at arboretum.ucdavis.edu, and RMI stands for Robert Mondavi Institute Courtyard.
We have a couple of other things coming up with the Master Gardeners. Boy, it's a busy summer. Usually our summers are so slow, but we have on June 11th, how to fix irrigation leaks to save water. And this is a it's very useful to know this stuff, man. So that would be a good one. And then June 25th, here you go, creating a 12-month garden. That's a marvelous thing to be able to do if you have the opportunity. And here it is. And those events are both with the Yolo County Master Gardeners. And you can go to their website to get more information about those and all the other events that are coming up.
You go to the UC Master Gardener Program of Yolo County. That's ucanr.edu. And you will find that if you just type, at least as of today, UC Master Gardener Program of Yolo County into Google, this will pop up. And there's the information about all these Zoom sessions, as well as the other events that they have, and their newsletter, which you can subscribe to, which, by the way, is great. So.
So, when we were talking earlier off air, Don said, "Well, I have this article," and he showed it to me. And it's titled "Check Daily, Water as Needed."
Sounds familiar,
This is where that phrase came from. This article, which was published in Davis Enterprise in 2007, if you read down in this article, it says the first rule of thumb: check the plants daily, water as needed. Yep, got that. And then the second rule of thumb, water every other day, the following amounts: 4-inch pot, a half gallon. Wait a minute, a half gallon is like a milk jug.
So this is a
All right.
guideline. It's at redwoodbarn.com. Let's see. The title of this article from 2007 is "Check Daily, Water as Needed." And this is how much to water things that you've just put in the ground. And it's like, oh,
Okay,
this was
that makes
published
more sense.
in, this is a June article. Maybe I should just send it to the editor and have him run it again. I'll make a few changes in
That
it. If you've
sounds good.
planted out a 4-inch pot or a 1-gallon can or a 5-gallon can or a 15-gallon can, here's how much water you need to give it every other day at first, for the first 1, 2, 3 weeks, depending on the weather and other factors.
So the place that you planted a 4-inch pot
Yes.
plant, put in a milk jug of water, a half gallon. And if it came out of a 1-gallon can, then you put in a gallon of water. That's easy to remember. Mm-hmm. And then with a 5-gallon can, 1.5 gallons of water, and a 15-gallon can, 2 gallons of water. Now, the reason that you're not having to put 5 times as much for a 5-gallon can as a 1-gallon can is that you're just watering the roots.
Well, also, we in the industry, we're not really supposed to use the terms gallon anymore because they don't hold 1 gallon or 5 gallons of anything. So those are old industry jargon. We now are supposed to call them a number 1 can, a number 5 can. So the number 5 can doesn't hold 5 times the volume of a number 1 can to begin with. That's just sort of industry terminology right there. The main thing that we're trying to get at is the plant that goes in the ground needs water, not just for the volume of soil that was in the container, but also the soil around it and below it. Longtime listeners to the program have heard this many times, but almost every day now, as we enter the month of June and through July, August, and September, we'll have conversations with people whose plants are struggling. They bring in pictures, we look at it, and we say, this appears to be drought stress. And they say, but we're watering every day. And the conversation then diverges in different directions. But what it boils down to is people have no idea what the output of their irrigation system is, and they're running it at a frequency that isn't related to the plant's specific needs. And so we end up essentially having to have the same sort of beginning irrigation conversation over and over again. Really what it comes back to is people often have irrigation systems put in and then they don't understand them. So they're set by the landscaper who is then done. And this is, literally had this conversation yesterday with someone whose tree was struggling. They had their front yard re-landscaped, which is a rather special situation. You have existing trees that were getting a certain type of watering. Netafim is the brand of irrigation that they put in, and they were running it. And so we have, you know, a series of questions. How often is it running? Oh, it runs every day. So, you know, we're thinking that's not optimal, but we'll come back to that. How long does it run? And they don't know how long it's running. Which is,
but then they don't know how much water they're putting
in. The most important part of the conversation is how much water are you presently giving so we can give you some guidance. So, you know, that tells, okay, so you need to go look at your timer. You need to look at the brand. I know this is sounding technical, but it's really important to run about 10 minutes a day, every day. Now, the part of this article that has changed, I believe I found the exact sentence that I'm going to have to correct. Most drip emitters put out 1 to 2 gallons per hour, I said in 2007. Netafim brand, I'm now editorializing, puts out 0.4 to 0.9 gallons per hour.
Oh my.
Yes, it's a very low output. That's why it's popular, because it can be used to conserve water, but it's a fraction, you know, 0.4 gallons versus 1 gallon, 0.4 gallons versus 2 gallons. Emitters have changed. Drip irrigation systems have changed over the last 20 to 25 years, and there's lower output. So think about this, 0.4 gallons per hour running for 10 minutes.
0.4 divided by 6 is
a coffee cup.
Less than 0.1?
It's a coffee cup of water that they're putting on the plant.
Oh, my goodness.
Every
day. No. You need to have a milk carton of water.
Well, it's a good start. So one of the things we often suggest, so if you're in this situation, here's an easy step forward. Take all of the whole week's worth of 10 minutes, add them up, put all of that on at once. Okay, 10 minutes a day, 7 days a week, try 70 minutes. And you can see their facial expression, 70 minutes. 70 minutes, you've now given the plant, you know, a gallon of water, if you're lucky, depending on the system, but it's better than what you were doing before. And then you'll go from there, because you'll need to probably run it longer than that, but that's a good starting point. Is the total amount of water for the week enough? Probably not, but at least you're now giving it more water all at once. You're not keeping the plant on the edge of death at all times.
And because you've given it that much water, it has percolated down and out so that the roots can expand, because we always know that roots can't grow into dry soil.
Right. And so we find ourselves saying, all right, try adding it all up and doing it all at once. Or we say, how about if you go home this afternoon, got any other projects to do? Great. Go turn the system on, let it run all afternoon. All afternoon. What? That's a lot of water. Yes. I want you to bring the soil to field capacity. I want you to saturate the soil and then have it drain out so that you know that everything below where that plant is and everything past where that plant is has moisture in it sufficient to sustain new root growth. And then, no, I don't want you doing that all the time. I just want you to get the whole area hydrated better. Then we can talk about what your setting is going to be after that. But you need to know the output. This is crucial. And you need to understand, I'm not trying to disparage landscapers, but I hear this so often that it's exasperating. What they're using is an old agricultural approach to this kind of drip irrigation. This brand was initially an agriculture brand. They were using calculations to replace what that melon plant needed in that greenhouse in Israel every single day, not giving it a full week's worth of water, not giving it deeper hydration, wider hydration. Every drop of water is precious in those situations. These are usually from desert environments. They've calculated it to the nth degree, to a degree that none of us are going to do. And they're providing every single day what that plant needed. That was the foundation of these kind of low output drip systems. They aren't appropriate at that with that usage in landscapes. It just doesn't translate that way. You need to be doing, like we're always talking about, watering deeper, watering wider every now and then. And daily watering invites fungus problems. So you want to get away from that surface being damp all the time. So we want deeper watering less often. So the first thing we started with was every other day for the newly planted plants. Every day might be, you know, what it seems to need, but if you keep it that wet, you might rot it. Every other day allows that surface a chance to dry out a little bit, reduces the likelihood of rot. And the problem is, if you go to a lot of places, a lot of hardware stores, a lot of nurseries, you walk in with your problem, they're going to say, oh, you're overwatering, which, as we know at the Davis Garden Show, is a meaningless term. So we don't use that term here. You're watering too often, perhaps. You're creating conditions favorable to crown rot, perhaps. That may be, but it's very rare nowadays for people to be watering, putting on too much water at any one time. By far the most common conversations we have are people watering very, very shallowly and frequently, and then the plants struggling. Your vegetable plants, your young summer flowers, young trees that you've put in, young, should be growing vigorously right now. They should be, this is when they should be focusing on growth and making flowering points in the case of your tomato plant. They should be vigorous, not stunted, not stressed. The more stunted and stressed they are now, the less yield you'll get overall. So deeper watering, less often. We make the point frequently here, but we really need to get back to this because we're having this conversation so often because of the conversion over to low water, low output watering systems.
Okay, we have a longtime listener, Wen Quinn, who has written in, and thank you so much for answering my questions on the last show. You provided me with a lot of great information. This was talking about shade trees.
Fastidiate trees. We taught everybody a new word. I think I may take a picture of my fastidiate heritage variety of oak because it looks great right now. Maybe that'll be the show picture on the catered show page, because this is it's a very distinctive growth habit that these trees have, and there's a lot of trees in that fastidiate category.
And she writes, I have a few follow-up questions, if you don't mind. Yep. Ideally, I would like to keep the privets alive until the new trees have grown to a good height. Would it work if I plant the new trees right in front of the privets so they get a little morning sun but no afternoon sun? I assume it's shading the privets. Yeah, privets appear very aggressive, so I'm afraid the new trees will not survive right next to them. However, I don't want to plant the new trees too far from the fence where the privets currently are.
Okay, we'll start with that one. Well, privet roots are definitely quite a network. Anybody who's dealt with them, you'll find as you dig even 3-4 feet away from the plant, you're cutting through a lot of smaller roots, which eventually get bigger. And I don't know that they're truly allelopathic in the sense of putting any toxin in the soil, but things don't seem to grow right under them, that's for sure. But the things we talked about could be compatible or competitive, I guess would be the term I would use. What you need is a shovel, like one of our listeners brought in and proudly showed me that he's using to keep redwood roots out of a planter area. It's a long, in the industry, we call them nurseryman's spades years ago, nursery spades, because they're a long, narrow spade, as much as 16 to 18 inches long, only about 5 or 6 inch diameter. Trenching spades are similar. And his that he found online was really impressive. One, it had some weight to it, so it did the work for you when he put it in the ground. It had a serrated blade, shovel edge. So it actually cuts through the soil. And the goal was, in his case, because redwood roots are invading where he's trying to plant this thing, every few months, he's going to do what nursery people do, hence the name nurseryman's spade. He's going to go out and he's just going to cut straight down around the plant with this spade. And he's already done this, and he's already cutting through redwood roots. So the idea is to just block those roots, cut them off for as long as it takes for the new plant to get established. Because if you don't, you'll turn all that nice. You'll make that nice big planting hole, put your new 15-gallon tree in, and those roots will happily invade in there because you're watering that area and you've loosened it and you've made very favorable conditions for the root growth. So you just go around, get one of these spades, and you want to go as deep as it can. So the longer, the better. And you just cut straight down in a circle around the tree. Why is this called a nurseryman's spade? Because in much of the rest of the world, nursery plants are grown out in the field. They're not grown in containers. Only in California, Arizona, you know, that's a relatively new phenomenon of growing nursery stuff in pots. It was grown in a field. You wanted to buy a shrub, you'd go out to that nursery guy on the edge of town, walk through the field, you'd point at the shrub you wanted, you go, all right, we'll have that there next week. And they bring in their nurseryman's spade and dig around it and dig it up and put it in ball and burlap, wire with burlap around it, and bring that to your house. And it weighed 150 pounds and you have yourself a shrub that was grown in a field. It always amazes me that there's an entire segment of my industry that does this. You go to nurseries back east, and you know the garden centers like mine, and they've just received a delivery. It'll be a whole bunch of bald and burlap things that were field grown sitting out front, each one weighing 80 to 100 pounds or more. Nurseryman's spade was used to prune their roots and keep them within the root ball. We're using it the other way around to keep roots out of the root ball. And that's one thing you can do. So that's the first, is to keep cutting those until the tree starts to get established.
So when you're cutting off the redwood roots that have invaded that nice juicy soil, you're not going to have to go in there and pull them out, are you? You just let them rot in place?
They're compost at that point. Perfectly right. Beneficial, right. Yeah. But if you do nothing, I've had people build, back in COVID, a lot of people were putting in new vegetable planters and filling them with soil and doing everything right. And then the yield would decline. The plants wouldn't grow as well. And oftentimes they'd send a picture. We were talking about nitrogen and watering because, you know, when you brought in fresh soil after a year or two, you have to replenish it. But then they'd have a picture and there'd be the neighbor's fence line would be all privets. And I go, oh dear, dig down in there and see what you're going to find. Oh yeah, I find all these roots in there. You're just basically feeding and watering your neighbor's privets at this point. So that's where cutting those roots on the edge of the
planter. You can use that shovel on the outside edge of the planter. Oh, okay.
I mean, you can get root barriers. They exist. Mostly they're sold by bamboo specialists. So if you all are in this area and you want to get a bamboo barrier, that'll work for keeping roots of aggressive trees out as well. And your average local bamboo supplier, such as Davis Bamboo or Bamboo Sorcery or any of the other good bamboo nurseries in the Bay Area, will typically have root barrier available, which is anywhere from 40 to 80 mil, really heavy duty plastic, which you can do. You can put that in, you can put a barrier in that solves your problem for many, many, many years. But it's expensive and you need to install it correctly. And you can, if this is just a temporary thing, in the case of a vegetable box, for example, you can keep cutting those roots. And here our goal is just to get the new tree holding its own against the privets until it's up and growing. And then you can probably stop with all this. And at that point, you'll probably be taking out the privets because the tree will have gotten to the point where it's giving you the privacy you're after. So this could be done, but the root competition from the privets could be a problem.
And if you decided to, you've got a row of privets, if you decided, well, I'll take out this one privet and I'll plant something there. And then later on, I'll take out another privet and plant something there. How soon after you cut down the privet, have the roots rotted enough that you can dig into it?
You can dig in right away. That's no problem. The roots will start to break down immediately. The question is whether the privet will
resprout.
The roots, no, but the stump will. So this is something you need to know about a particular plant. Privets, for example, and Pittosporum tibira and several other plants, if you cut them to the ground, they'll resprout immediately. So you haven't killed them by cutting them down by any stretch. But if you cut them down, let's say you treat the stump or you just keep chopping it and don't allow it to regrow, yes, the roots will begin to wither right away. So as far as that goes, they don't re-sprout. There are exceptions to that. Tree of heaven, Ailanthus altissima, comes up from the root. There are plants that do. Bamboo is a rhizome. So you may have cut down this part of it, but that rhizome is still over there. It can resprout. But for the most
part, apples are another one.
Yeah, crab apple. Any that are notable for suckering problems, and crab apples are definitely noted for that. In fact, they are so well noted for it If you're in crabapple country and you want to buy a crabapple, ask your local nursery about the ones that are on the new rootstock that doesn't sprout. You can learn all about that from Frank Schmidt Company up in Oregon. They have a sprout-free rootstock, which would really save us a lot of trouble with crabapples. They're not a big deal in our area, but I know up in the Pacific Northwest, they're a very popular tree, and root suckering is a big problem. So many plants will resprout only from the stem. A handful will come back from the roots. Privets would only come back from the stem. I can tell you'll have to cut them down repeatedly. They will try to resprout for quite a long time, but if you keep after them, those roots will basically wither and become compost.
So I guess my question is, if one wanted to plant in the same area as the privet is, would you just cut it down and cut it down and cut it down and cut it down? And how long would you have to wait before you could plant there?
If you're just going to try and let it break down on its own, it's going to take a couple of years at least. So if you want to replant right where it is, you have to dig it out. I've done that. It takes, for an average privet, 4 hours of labor to dig out the whole stump and as much of the root system as near the stump as possible. We run into this problem, and I don't think this is an issue here, fortunately, but someone will have like a raised planter that was built in and a tree right in the middle. And they have to replace that tree for some reason. So the new tree has to go right where the old tree was. Well, there you've got a problem. Because even if you have the stump ground out by a tree service, they're going to grind it down 6, 8,
To
10,
the
12
top
inches
of the planter.
to whatever the stump grinder will reach. And then that's it. You haven't gotten it all out by any stretch. No, it's just labor. It's just work at that point. If you need to plant right there, you have to excavate around it and cut the roots that you can't dig out and dig out the stump. And I've done it. It's, as I say, we did it with a small mulberry here, and the two of us took about 4 hours total. It's labor, but that's really all it is. It's better, easier. Life will be much simpler if you can just move over a couple of feet because the root system is never evenly distributed. So when we were landscapers and we would run into this situation, we would say, well, I'm going to try and put this tree here, but we're going to find the right spot to dig the right hole. We're not going to shoehorn the tree roots into a little tiny area just because it needs to be in this exact location. We need to be able to dig a proper planting hole. So we'll just move over a couple of feet. We almost invariably found just a couple of feet was all it took. You didn't have to go 10 feet away. You didn't have to excavate in a big way. You just had to find a place where it was possible to dig a proper planting hole. The hole does not have to be perfectly round. It can be oval, it can be square, it can be whatever shape it takes. It just has to be big enough for the new plant that's going to go in.
I'm going to come back to Wenquin's comments and questions. If I plant columnar zelkovas and prune them to strong lateral branches 5 to 6 years after planting to control their height, will this require pruning only once or periodic pruning for rest of the tree's life? Will it involve pruning many branches on each tree or just pruning out the central leader? According to the internet, columnar zelkovas can grow 40 to 50 feet tall, so I want to ensure I can feasibly control their height, otherwise they will be too tall. And remember, from her earlier message, she wanted it to be 20 to 25 feet maximum.
It wouldn't be too hard to keep one of these upright forms of Zelkova. For those who don't know, the tree Zelkova is an elm relative that looks a lot like an elm and became very popular when Dutch elm disease killed out elms all over the United States back in the early to mid part of the 20th century. A lot of areas where elms had been popular replanted instead of planting new elms because they were all dying, they planted Zelkova. And there are many parts of Davis, some of the older neighborhoods like Elmwood Drive. Those aren't elms, they're Zelkovas. Yes, they're big trees, 50, 60 feet. They're also 80 plus years old. So, well, I get your concern. The size of this tree is a pretty long way down the road. It would not be that difficult to control the height. It would be best if you had an actual certified arborist doing this because they're going to be getting up on a ladder and they're going to be making some fairly important strategic decisions. So you'll need to make it clear what you're after. It is not just a once pruning, though. It would require periodic pruning for the rest of the tree's lives if everybody who's living in those two houses just doesn't want that kind of height. Now, if you stop, a new leader will almost certainly form on this, particularly these strongly fastidiate types of trees. They have a very strong tendency to form a new leader, and then it will grow gradually to 45 to 50 feet. That's 30 plus years down the road. So again, give some consideration to the timeline on this. But to answer your question specifically, Yes, a few years down the road, you'll make some decisions about the height. And then every, let's say, 2 to 4 years after that, someone will need to come in and just retain that height by correct pruning. It's not hard to do. This is not something that's going to be super, super expensive or anything like that. But you will need to make sure that that height is retained the way you want it to be.
So how low to the ground are the lowest branches on this tree? And how wide will the tree get?
Your choice as to how, well, not your choice, it's the grower's choice as to how low the lowest branches are. I really wish wholesale tree growers would leave the lower branches on all the trees they grow, because it makes a stronger tree that establishes in the landscape better, typically without even requiring staking. It's a better balanced tree. Unfortunately, it's been true for as long as I can remember that nurseries prune them up to make a bare trunk because that's what they think the public wants. And so they take all the lower branches off, and we bring in a 15-gallon tree. There's never branches on the first, say, 5 feet. For some reason, they don't do that with birch trees or redwoods or certain others, but pretty much any other species you're sure to get with those lower branches removed. I have one grower who has what he calls a column. Instead of pruning off the lower branches, he just side prunes them because they need the space in the wholesale grounds. They don't want them crowding each other, but he leaves them. And that makes a stronger tree, in my opinion. So to answer your question, they would have lower branches if the growers would leave them. What was your other question?
How wide does it get?
In 10 years, this columnar zelkova, and this goes for things like the heritage oak and some of the other fastidiate types of trees we mentioned, they will be 6 feet across, whereas the regular form non-fastidiate version would be 12 feet across. So it's a very upright growth habit, but 5 to 6 feet apart would be reasonable spacing if you're trying to grow these as a hedge.
If I plant columnar zelkova and prune them, how far apart should the trees be spaced? Six to 10 feet. And when do zelkovas drop their leaves in the fall?
Late November to early December in this area.
Okay.
And they have nice fall color. It's interesting. It's more purplish red. It's not showy, but it's pretty.
All right. We've got a question here. As there, a tree is struggling, it's not growing much, the leaves look anemic and stressed, and it's a maple tree that is several years old. So it said the area was re-landscaped and drip irrigation was installed. The landscaper put in a Netafim system, and the landscaper originally set it for 10 minutes, 3 times a week, but it has now been changed to 3 times a week for 45 minutes. The other plants on the line are drought tolerant plants. Yeah. What should this person do?
That's a big challenge because you have a high water tree surrounded by low water plants. And so what's going to guide the timing of this, unless you can recalibrate this whole system somehow, is the maple tree's water needs. And it's already struggling because of this changeover. So the first thing, if you're re-landscaping your yard, let's say you're taking out your lawn and you're going to put in low water landscaping, and many people are embarking on that now. This is actually a really good time of year to start thinking about what you're going to do, how you're going to do this step by step. Let's say you're going to use cardboard and mulch, or whatever you're going to do. You're going to use a tarp. You're going to mulch with arborist wood chips, any of the various techniques you find online for getting rid of your lawn and planting low water landscaping in the fall. There are almost certainly trees on the perimeter of that whose roots are under that soil that have been living on the lawn watering or the nearby irrigation. And if you're going to shut that off, those trees will be very adversely affected. This tree was showing, you know, we haven't been that hot, and this tree was showing marginal burn on the leaves, burnt areas extending up in between the veins, scorched appearance on the leaves that were facing what I presume to have been the south, southwest, because that's where you typically see the sunburn. Pretty classic sunburn symptoms. And it's not just sunburn. Maples can take full sun in the case of this particular variety. You get these symptoms when it's under irrigated in full sun. And they've shifted over to low water. Well, if you're doing the same thing, please keep watering the trees. And it can be really simple. There's a 3-ring irrigation system that you can find online, simplified tree irrigation system that was developed at the UC Davis Center for Urban Horticulture. And it's really, in principle, it's very simple. You take a ring of drip, put it around near the trunk, more or less, a couple feet out. A ring of drip, put it about the middle of the drip line, the line of where rainfall falling from the tree would fall on the ground. That's what we mean by the drip line. And then one more line outside the perimeter of the existing tree drip line. So 3 rings that are running around this tree. And you run them for, hold your breath, 18 to 24 hours.
What?
Every couple of weeks. And that will give the tree what it needs and get it through this process of killing the turf or whatever it is that was above it that was previously getting water from the sprinklers on the lawn. It's going to be getting less water than it was because typically lawn sprinklers run 2 to 3 times a week, sometimes daily, putting out a lot of water. So that tree was probably getting significantly more water than you'll be giving it now. But at least you'll be hydrating the root zone very thoroughly about every 1 to 2 weeks, which is what most trees would benefit from if they're relatively high water trees. Thorough soaking every 1 to 2 weeks. They need many gallons of water when they get it. So with a drip system that's putting it out slowly, you can run it for 18 to 24 hours and go a good long time before you need to do that again. You can measure in your own soil how long you need to go. A week after you've done that soaking, take a trowel, start digging down, see what the soil moisture feels like. We're aiming for an 18 to 24 inch depth of irrigation every 1 to 2 weeks for a relatively young tree like this one. An older established tree could go longer, probably would benefit from a longer irrigation, but could go longer between waterings.
So when you say a ring of drip, mm-hmm. Now when I first heard that, I was thinking, oh, a soaker hose, but no, you said drip. So yeah. How frequently on that ring are the drip emitters? I'm assuming you're talking about emitters.
Yeah, you can put them in. I put them in every 2 feet when I do this, and I'm using a 2 gallon an hour output. So you can buy them emitterized. You can buy the emitterized tubing where they're already installed. Typically they're 1 foot apart, but you can buy them with a wider spacing if you want to, and a relatively high output. So the products are going to vary as to what people are going to find as they go out and do this. Personally, I do 2 gallon an hour every 2 feet when I do something like this. And your goal is to get at least a really well hydrated strip of soil. No, the whole root zone is not going to be irrigated by this. Even 18 to 24 hours is not going to get the entire root zone watered. You'll never get the whole root zone watered. Irrigation systems aren't that perfect, but you'll at least be watering a significant percentage of the existing roots when you do this. And that part of it is capillary action, as we like to say here, is your friend. So you run it that long, not only is it going down, but it's going out. It wouldn't surprise me if you've got most of the root zone hydrated with a very long soaking like that. Obviously, if you're really concerned about it, you could put more rings, but this is a simplified drip irrigation system to get a tree through a drought setting where you've removed the turf. And so you're giving the tree mostly what it needs most of the time with a system that's really easy to install and easy for you to manage, because you don't have to hook this up to a timer at all. This can go right on your hose, turn it on, let it run at a moderate flow, and overnight, 24 hours, 36 hours, depending on what your goal is. But that's the key, is to have it not just at the base of the tree, not just in the middle of the drip line of the tree, but also all the way out to the edge of where the drip line is, and even past that a little bit. Because you know the roots go well past the existing canopy of the tree.
Well, Don, it's June. Can you believe that? It's June already. And that means I've got a new calendar page to look at. It's wonderful. For those of you who want to follow along, redwoodbarn.com/calendar, and that is capitalized, /June26.jpg, and that is not capitalized. And there you will see Salvia splendens, which is the most vibrant red-orange color I've seen in a long time.
Well, we'll come back to that one because that's an important conversation. Go ahead.
Well, we can't do it now. I've got all June to do the rest of it.
You'll run through them first, then we'll talk.
Okay. About Lavatera, mm-hmm. Woodlea, that he has Black Knight up there, mm-hmm. Penstemon, and he has Painted Lady up there, Ipomoea, that's Morning Glory. What?
Yeah. We just keep...
I pronounced that one correctly, didn't I?
It keeps sneaking into our conversations, much less into your yard.
A pumpkin flower.
Yeah, those are cool.
Mandevilla laxa.
That's
a hollyhock. Mm-hmm. A geranium Johnson's blue. A clematis. And Onotheria.
Yep. So of those,
Onothera.
Let's talk about the Ipomoea for a moment. Morning Glory. Last year, I think I talked about this last year. Every few years, I plant Morning Glories because I love them. I think the flowers are really cool. They're one of my favorite flowers to photograph, by the way. And so they're fun for that. They give quick cover. They're very showy. So I planted two little garden structures out in my vegetable garden with Morning Glory, knowing full well that they would reseed, which they do. Every few years I do this, and the next year or two I get rid of the seedlings. And then when they're completely gone, I forget how bad it was and I plant them again. Where I planted them, I should take a picture of this. Each one of those structures has a carpet of Morning Glory seedlings, probably 100 or more, coming up right underneath the structure again. The color has changed slightly since we're now, you know, second generation seed is going to be a little bit different color range than what I planted. They're already blooming. They're very pretty. And I looked at it and said, you know what? You can cover this structure again, just no further than that. So they're going to stay on that structure and they're going to get another year of growth on my property. So if you happen to plant the annual beautiful Ipomoea Morning Glory, the one Heavenly Blue is the best known variety. It's been around for many, many, many years. Be aware that its problem is it reseeds like crazy. And the seed can lie in the soil for 10 to 20 years. It's a good hard seed coat, so it could just lie there waiting to germinate. So I know I've created a half a generation's worth of hassle for myself by planting this, but I'm on the farm. It's an isolated area. I could just rototill it if I had to. In your garden, they can be quite a hassle because they can go from seedling to scrambling up on things very quickly. However, I consider them very manageable compared to the other one.
Okay, so this one, you said the blue one is most common. I want lavender.
Well, they exist.
When I started here living in Davis as a student, I got some lavender morning glories and I thought, oh, that's beautiful. And so I would carefully harvest some seeds and every place that I went, I had morning glory, lavender morning glories. And then when I got to a place where I could stay for a while, they stopped being lavender.
Yeah, the second generation will, the multiple generations of seedlings will change in many species, will have slight color change, either back crossing to the original parents or just the natural variation within the species. And the Heavenly Blue Morning Glory is a true blue color, which is hard to find in the garden. True blue is very, very desirable for gardeners because it's an unusual, the rarest color in gardening, they say. Yes, subsequent generations are more purple, more reddish purple. They're okay, they're pretty, but they're not the true blue color that I started with. I also would like to apologize to anyone who lives in the place that I used to live, because these are undoubtedly still there because I plant them everywhere I go. Aware of morning glory, but the annual one, at least the seedlings, are very recognizable.
Where do I get lavender though?
I'm going to discourage you from planting morning glory, but the one that really is a concern is the perennial one that nurseries are still selling.
Oh no.
At this point, I will order it for someone if they want it. Just as with
Long lecture.
Yes, just as with Japanese honeysuckle. And I'll say, if you don't pick this up, I'm going to throw it out. I'm not going to put it out for sale. So please come pick it up when we contact you, because why would you throw it out? Because I don't want someone planting this without knowing how vigorous and potentially locally invasive. I mean, it's a real garden thug. And I've seen yards overtaken by this perennial morning glory. It does not seed. It's true. It is naturally sterile. It makes up for that. Extremely vigorous, running across the ground, rooting and scrambling up onto things. Now, it's only vegetative in the case of the perennial Blue Dawn Skyflower. Ipomoea acuminata is the botanical name. That one is perennial, and it's really problematic in a typical yard. And I do need to mention, if you have this vine, anything in the Morning Glory family, the juice can make you sick. So if you're pulling it down, if you're a landscape worker and you're working, this is true for anything because you don't necessarily know, but I can tell you this one, be sure to wear gloves, be sure to wear long sleeves, because if you get a whole lot of that sap on your hands and your arms, you will feel nauseous. It's not good for you. A little bit of clipping and trimming you out in the garden, I'm not too concerned about. It's the day you decide to take it down. And you're going to spend 4 to 6 hours pulling this stuff and getting it on your hands and so forth. It's going to cause some stomach upset, among other symptoms. Let's shift over to something else here, like the salvia. The
one you're Salvia spendens.
Spendens. Yes, that is the annual sage, the scarlet sage. Oh. It was really the only sage that most people knew for a long time in the garden, other than the culinary or, you know, kitchen herb sage. Now the genus Salvia, right now I have 50 different kinds of salvias available to me. They're almost entirely shrubs or herbaceous perennials, but this one goes way back. And the annual salvias, Salvia splendens, are great garden plants. They're hot colors. They're usually bright red. Some of them are dark purple. There's white. They attract hummingbirds like crazy. They also attract the big xylocopa bees, the carpenter bees, and a lot of other bees will go to them. And they're just a really cheerful, easy, full sun annual that in my experience actually can last as if it were a short-term perennial. They'll often make it through the winter and try to bloom a second year. And some of the new ones, like the Texas hummingbird sage, is an annual variant of Salvia splendens that will reseed and it'll sort of naturalize here and there, but not to the point of being annoying. So I just think salvias are some of the best garden plants in so many ways because they give bloom over a very long season. I have taken pictures of certain types of salvia blooming as early as March and as late as October and November. And I have varieties of salvia that are blooming right through the winter. So you can get blooms year-round just focusing on that genus. But people should go back to these annual ones. They're really easy to grow. You can grow them from seed quite readily. You still have time to plant the seed in most places. And if you don't happen to have a source of seed, your local garden center probably has the annual salvia available still in the bedding plant department. Great, bright colors, easy to grow. Full sun is best. There are salvias that can take light shade as well.
Is this the thing that they used to call Victoria?
No, that's a particular short-lived perennial salvia, Victoria Blue. That one is sold in the bedding plant section of your garden center. But in our area, as zone USDA zones 9 and 10, the plant will last 2 to 3 years, actually.
It's really short, isn't it?
Well, the shorter ones were a big improvement. Yes, the old ones were tall, 18 to 24 inches, sky blue flowers, very pretty. And they bloom basically, you know, spring through early fall, mid-fall even. And then most people would just cut them back and treat them like an annual and pull them out. I cut them down and learned years ago that in mixed plantings in a barrel or something like that, they're almost sure to come right back up, either in the fall or more commonly in the spring, and continue to bloom for at least a second year. So a lot of these things that are sold as annuals are actually technically short-lived perennials. And that one's a true blue color. So there's salvias for every situation. Anywhere you're listening, there's something in the genus salvia that you can grow. Almost anywhere, because there are some that can take extreme cold. There are herbaceous perennials. There's a lot of woody shrubs that are very hardy and very drought tolerant. There's a lot of subtropical and tropical species. It's a big, big group of plants. But for home gardeners, it's one of the best for drawing beneficials into the garden, because big bees love them, hummingbirds love them, and they're very, very easy to grow.
And so we have a true blue in the salvia, mm-hmm. and we have a true blue in the morning glory.
Choosing between them, I'd stick with the salvia.
Yes, yes, yes. But I think we also have a true blue in clematis, don't we?
There are true blue clematis and also a lot that are purple. Yeah, that's a vine that we love to grow. It grows in the shade, so it's not that many. There aren't that many plants that grow and bloom in the shade. It also will grow up into the sun and bloom fine in the sun as long as the roots are shaded. We've talked about clematis many times here because it just gives such a big burst of color. And there are varieties that make it possible to extend that burst of color, at least from the genus, from as early as February in the case of the Clematis armandii to as late as September in the case of the fall blooming one. So you, with careful selection, you can have a lot of bloom on clematis.
We'll talk more about June flowers from that calendar, but I want to get into our weekly question to Don. Mm-hmm. What are you harvesting now, Don?
Harvesting, or we just picked apriums. Apriums. Yep. Those are quite good. Flavor Delight Aprium. It's an apricot plum hybrid. We've Santa Rosa plums are coming in hot and heavy. And we got another plum that's getting ready to ripen, another pluot. So basically, May is the earliest period for most of the stone fruits. May is when your blueberries are mostly ripe. I'm picking some of those right now. May, late April, May, early June, typical blueberry harvest season here in the Sacramento Valley. And then we'll be getting into all the other stone fruits, the earliest of the peaches, for example, mid to late June, and then, of course, heavy production on into the summer. But the plums come on first, and the berries, blackberries, some of them, blueberries, harvesting right now.
Are you still planting seeds to grow in your greenhouse, or have you stopped
that? Yes. No, we're starting things in cucurbitaceae right now. So that what that means is anything that's related to a melon, squash, pumpkin. We have found that a really effective unit to sell is the 3-inch pot where we've just germinated them and they're just getting their true leaves, nice healthy plants just rooted to the bottom. It takes literally 10 to 14 days from time of plant to sale. So we put them out and people get nice healthy plants that way. That's a great way to go. Yes, of course, you could plant those seeds yourself out in your garden. When I do that, it seems that the critters feel that I've done it for them. Whereas when I plant a seedling, they just seem to leave them alone by comparison. If you're having a problem with little seedlings you're putting out, especially those tender little cucumbers and melons and squash, a strawberry basket flipped over the top and pushed into the soil a little bit will help get it past that first very vulnerable stage. But it's still plenty of time to plant summer vegetables. You can plant tomatoes still. You can plant peppers. Eggplant are going in now very heavily. Squash, melons, pumpkins, winter squash all go in now. The month of June is when I really plant those. Notice I said squash and winter squash. And this is confusing to people. We've got to come up with another name, like I've said before, for
storage quote, squash.
Storage squash, root cellar squash. I mean, something that gives the idea that you're growing them for the winter to eat, not to grow. You grow them the same season as your summer squash and your pumpkins and your melons, but you harvest them.
You could call them holders.
Holders, keepers. Yeah, that keepers. One's a keeper. There we go. That one's a keeper squash. Those go in my garden. They're one of the last things I plant because they take a lot of space and I got to figure out where they're going to go. And they go on an emitter down at the end. I just let them run wherever they want to. So I'll plant those anytime in the month of June. Pumpkins for the jack-o'-lantern trade are historically planted late June or the 1st of July, and you'll be harvesting them the end of September, 1st of October. Pumpkins can go in anytime through the month of June. So anything in that family can go in right now. And I'm going to echo my friend Debbie Flower when she's on Fred Hoffman's show. She makes this point all the time. Buying root-bound, overgrown members of Cucurbitaceae is a recipe for failure. So if you're at the garden center, the hardware store, and it's blooming, and it's clearly a big plant in a little pot, I do this myself. I take them home, I tear those roots apart, I put them in the ground. There's about a 10-day period of transition as they sit there, do nothing, and then finally start to grow. So you've lost almost 2 weeks of the growth cycle of the plant when you buy an overgrown plant. Look for the fresh stock that just came in, or start it yourself and get it out there as quickly as you possibly can. Root-bound members of Cucurbitaceae do not establish well.
Well, today I have two quotations for you, and that's because they go so well together. First is CZ Guest, and they said, "Gardening is the best therapy in the world." Okay. And the next is Christopher Lloyd. You know Christopher Lloyd. He's that humorous TV star.
Yes.
And Christopher Lloyd said, "Good gardening and a quiet life seldom go hand in hand."
I have to give that some thought. You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore
and Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.
Check out the other great programming here at KDRT. Implosion is hosted by Nick Solomon, front person of the British neo-psychedelic rock band The Bevis Frond. Every week, Nick presents a sample of the music he loves, plus some stories behind the tunes. Genres span roots and rock, folk, beat, jazz, soul, psychedelia, punk, and much more. That's Wednesdays 4 to 5 p.m. For the replays, just visit kdrt.org and click the schedule guide.